Welcome back, everyone. Let's close out this week, the Damage Report, with John Arola and also Brett Ehrlich.
Brett Ehrlich, Team Paul Ryan.
Team, where did you, did we have that in the back?
This is under my desk.
That's
at all times.
That's my
time.
Copy of I'm the fountainhead.
Really, this is not your copy anymore. It's been under my desk. And okay. That is bootstrapping. That is the power of the individual to make a fountainhead book one's own. Team Paul Ryan, Team Paul Ryan.
If you're listening to the podcast, he is holding up a copy of Ayn Rand's famous novel, The Fountainhead. Well, I was going to say we're glad to have you here, but now it's sort of wishy-washy. I don't know, but we have a lot to talk about.
I'm glad to be here.
And I can't actually get rid of you because you're wired in through mics. Yep. So we're gonna be talking about the latest on the Acosta saga, some big progress there. Donald Trump, a little bit more of him talking about his relationship with Epstein. That's gonna be fun. Look, we've got media coverage of Bernie Sanders. We've got an update on AOC's big failure in New York City. How's that actually turning out? Let's see, we're gonna talk about the vaccine movement and Colin Kaepernick used in a Republican ad, and wait until you see how they used Photoshop to portray him. You're not really gonna be shocked, they do it all the time. But it is disgusting and racist, and we'll be breaking that down a little bit later on. But let's jump into the news because time she is a-wasting. Donald Trump facing even more scrutiny on his past statements on Epstein, his relationship with the financier, who looks like he might be spending a good amount of time in prison, as well as updates on Alexander Acosta, which we'll have for you. Donald Trump did his morning walk to the helicopter news conference thing that he does, and he was asked about Epstein, some of his past comments about him. Here's what he said.
And I did have a falling out a long time ago. Reason doesn't make any difference, frankly, but I haven't spoken to him in probably 15 years or more. I wasn't a big fan of Jeffrey Epstein, that I can tell you. And now, if you look, the remnants hurt this man, and I hate to see it happen.
Okay, so not a big fan of him. Had a
provably
falling out.
False.
So the interesting thing is he says he had a falling out. I just sort of assume that that's made up, but let's say it's real that they did have a falling out. When he says we had a falling out, the reason's not important. I just instantly think, oh, now I want to know what the reasoning is.
Well, I also say if I'm not a fan of him, wasn't a fan of him. Well, if you had a falling out previous to your falling out, you were a fan of him.
You by your own statements appear to be a fan of him.
I don't have fallings out with people I
hated.
Was in with. Yeah, I do. Only you have to be in with someone before you can have
out.
A falling out.
Yes.
That's just one of those implicit confessions. Mm-hmm. However, he is just saying things. And you heard the whole press court say when he said, I'm not a fan of him. Everyone's like, what about that thing where we're going to run in the piece about this? Which
yes,
you are too.
We're going to get to that quote in just a second. I want to go to a little bit more video of Donald Trump, who not only didn't like this guy, but also is going to give himself some credit in the matter.
I was not a fan of Jeffrey Epstein. And you watched people yesterday saying that I threw him out of a club. I didn't want anything to do with him. That was many, many years ago. It shows you one thing, that I have good taste, okay? Now, other people, they went all over with him. They went to his island. They went all over the place. He was very well known in Palm Beach. His island, whatever his island was, wherever it is, I was never there. Find out the people that went to the island. But Jeffrey Epstein was not somebody that I respected.
Okay, so wasn't a fan of him, didn't respect him, kicked him out, and that proves that Donald Trump has good taste. So we're gonna go through a couple of different statements that Trump has made, both recently and previously, to see if he has good taste. So today, we're gonna be getting into the Acosta updates in just a little bit, but Trump said this, he made a deal with Epstein that people are happy with, and then 12 years later, they're not happy with it. You'll have to figure all of that out. But the fact is, so that's not the important part. The important part there is, so when judging how critical of Epstein is Trump, we're not talking now about what he might have known 15 years ago. We're talking about Trump's evaluation of what happened in 2008 when this billionaire got an incredibly good deal. Trump thinks, yeah, people were happy with it. It was perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Yes, this guy might have raped 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 or more women. But you know, he had to spend a few hours a day in jail. People were happy with that. So how critical really are you if you're looking back and saying that that deal was good? Trump doesn't have to defend the deal. He has no obligation to. He's choosing to defend it.
No, it's not that he's choosing to I wouldn't call it that. That's not his priority here. His priority is
I'm not defending it. I've made the opposite choice. Could he not attack the deal?
But that's not his priority here. His priority here is to create a reality. Mm-hmm. And his reality that he's creating is that people were fine with this deal until politics got involved. Mm-hmm. That's what he's trying to do.
And that's not implying that he's fine with the deal?
I'm saying, yes, it is implying that you're pulling that out, but he's not appealing to folks who can read what's being implied versus not implied. He's just appealing to folks who read, people are happy with that deal. So they must have been happy. That's right. Politics did get involved. That's how deep the messaging goes. Mm-hmm. You're pulling out what's right. What I would say is people were not happy with the deal, specifically the victims of Epstein who were not told about the deal until after the deal was made, which itself is horrible. Of course, no one's happy with that deal. The only people that are happy with the deal are the defenders of Jeffrey Epstein who were at the time working at the same law firm that Acosta used to work at.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a giant inside deal that it is exactly what you're afraid of when you think of a bunch of rich people getting together and saying, it's fine, we'll just let them off. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, children were raped. Yeah. And I feel histrionic and crazy when I say children were raped because it sounds like Pizzagate. But no, provably, children were raped.
Yeah, yeah. And I would just ask that if you are trying to present it as you've always had a problem with this guy's behavior, back before, like if we are taking his version of reality, which is that he didn't know anything was happening until after the falling out, because the falling out happened before the 2008 thing, according to Trump. So if we accept his description of reality, then he should be even more critical of this guy to find out that his suspicions were right and this guy was in fact raping people, to then say, well, you know, we got a deal, like people are happy, it's fine. That to me undercuts the argument. Well, but I get what you're saying, some people are not gonna see that level.
Let's get to the part where he said that Epstein was.
Well, yeah, let's just go to the quote that we've shown you many times before. So during the period in which Trump was never a fan of Epstein, didn't respect him, and in fact was thinking about throwing him out of his club and not having any relationship with him, to say that you don't respect him, you're not a fan of him, what about the core issue with him, which is his predilection towards children and the sexualizing of children? Well, Trump said in 2002, Epstein's a terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. No doubt about it, Jeffrey enjoys his social life. So the only thing about Epstein that you should have been able to identify as an issue at the time was the fact that he was sexually attracted to children. Not only did Trump not call that out as an issue before their falling out when he wasn't a fan of him, but in fact lauded that as the best thing about him.
Yeah, that's the thing. You would assume the falling out had something to do with raping girls.
Evidently not.
And is like creepy sex parties. Even if you don't think that he's actually raping girls, he's having these creepy sex parties. Well, obviously, Trump's cool with that.
Yeah.
So something else.
He's enthusiastic about it.
Something else must have happened, which.
But the reason's unimportant.
The reason to me that is very likely is like Trump wasn't invited to a sex party on the island. Mm-hmm. And that's why they had a falling out. I don't believe there was a falling out, but if there was a falling out, it would have been over something like that.
It
because
could be
he's already
money related.
He's cool.
I don't know. Yeah. It could be, and perhaps we'll find out. Although not at the island, because he's never been at the island. He was very clear about that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even know what an island is. But if there is one, it's surrounded by big ocean water. Okay, let's turn to another development on this story. One of the big topics involved in the Epstein and Trump legal drama that's been developing is the presence of Labor Secretary Acosta, who was of course involved back in 2008 with Epstein getting that sweetheart deal. There's been a lot of pressure for there to be some sort of consequences for him. He was a divisive choice for that position to begin with, and at the time there was not much of an argument to be made for why he was being chosen. It seemed weird, especially considered what we later found out. Well, as of today, Acosta is gone. He's stepping out. And probably going back to representing billionaires and trying to get away from, you know, the crimes that they committed.
Nice.
But in any event, we do have this sort of impromptu gathering this morning where it was announced. Let's take a look.
Alex called me this morning and he wanted to see me. And I actually said, well, we have the press right out here. So perhaps you just want to say it to the press. But I just want to let you know, this was him, not me. because I'm with him. He was he's a tremendous talent. He's a Hispanic man. He went to Harvard, a great student. And in so many ways, I just hate what he's saying now because we're gonna miss him.
You know, Brett at one point was, you know, he was behind the scenes, a very important part of this show. It was very sad when he left. You know, he's a creative guy. He's a Jewish man. He went to a good school. What?
That's so amazing that he's just like, he was a good guy, Hispanic. I have a Hispanic. Now I have to get a new Hispanic.
So weird.
It's exactly, and that was a big thing because he was the first Hispanic person that was touted by Trump in the cabinet that he selected.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just weird. It's just the most Trump moment you can imagine in something like that.
Yeah, look, the good thing is that he is going to get out. I mean, we'll have to look to see who's going to take his spot because that's probably going to be its own fresh hell. But he is moving on. Trump, of course, does that weird thing where, like, they're leaving, but it always has to be, I didn't want them to leave. I didn't make them leave. I didn't imply to them that they're hurting me and my reputation by the terrible things that they've done. It's just totally them. I'm totally with them. I don't get that. That's what he does always. He'll eventually go on to attacking Acosta when Acosta releases a book that's critical of him or whatever. But he does have to defend him at the time. We do have a little bit of video from Acosta though. And take a look at the spin that he's gonna put on that deal he got in 2008 that's been so criticized.
Cabinet positions are temporary trust. It would be selfish for me to stay in this position and continue talking about a case that's 12 years old rather than about the amazing economy we have right now. And so I submitted my resignation to the president effective 7 days from today, effective 1 week from today, earlier this morning.
Okay, so the headline is, here's two men who were really mad at Epstein. It was a terrible thing that he did. And Trump's like, people were happy with the deal. And Acosta's like, it was 12 years old. Come on, get off my back.
Yeah, you know, this deal was 12 years old. In 3 years old, it's old enough to get raped by Epstein. In 3 years, it will be perfectly that
age. See, that's a critical take on what he did. Unambiguous. Them, ambiguous.
Ambiguous. He did something terrible. The reason that we're in this now, the reason that we're talking about Epstein being under, you know, being arrested for these charges is because Acosta let him off so easy before.
Yeah, if Acosta had done his job, not only would the victims have been happier at the time, but we wouldn't be in this position right now. He wouldn't be in that position.
So maybe
do your job in the future.
I wanna point out, like, because of people like us, two huge things have happened this week. There will be no citizenship question on the census, and a man who facilitated the ongoing rape and encouraged the easy treatment of a billionaire who is a swamp creature, he is no longer the labor secretary. This guy who just recently proposed slashing a budget that would go towards protecting children from human trafficking.
At least he's consistent. But that's true. So thank you for everybody who's been pushing on those issues. I'm gonna leave you with just one more quote from Trump about the citizenship question, just because you talked about that other comment being the most Trumpian thing. So this is from Daniel Dale. Trump says getting citizenship information through government data will be, quote, actually more accurate than a census. Asked if he backed down, he said not only did he not back down, quote, I backed up.
What?
I don't know.
What? What, your hard drive?
I don't know what that. Oh, you dummy. But anyway, we win this time at least. I'm sure they'll get us somehow. But
so stupid.
Okay, so that's all we got for this. We've gone massively over. When we come back, lots more to get to, so stick around.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
It is 2019. It's been 3 years since the 2016 primary. It's a very different primary with far more candidates. And yet there are some things about the two primaries, though years apart, that do seem sort of similar. And the media coverage of certain types of candidates, there is a sort of through line from 2019 stretching back to 2016. And joining us now to break that down, Kate Aronoff, contributor to The Intercept and writing fellow at In These Times. Kate, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently wrote an op-ed about the coverage of Bernie Sanders in certain types of outlets. And so talking about 2016 and 2019, what are some of the things that you think are similar? And are there areas where there has been evolution in the coverage of candidacies like Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I mean, what's still really clear is that most sort of mainstream corporate controlled outlets are still annoyed by Bernie Sanders. And I think what's evolved this time around is that they're annoyed that he hasn't gone away, right? Like, I don't think that most outlets are, you know, actively plotting against Bernie Sanders and involved in some sort of underhanded plot to undermine his candidacy. But I do think that they really just don't want to be covering him anymore and are sort of sick of having to give credence to a democratic socialist, having to cover someone who is so consistently sort of challenging much of what they hold dear.
Have you noticed any more representation in these sorts of outlets from writers who come from that side of the spectrum that might identify as democratic socialists, who might be a little bit more inclined towards someone like Bernie Sanders or a candidate like him? Are you seeing a little bit more of that sort of representation?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think one thing that 2016 did was to sort of send the message that the sort of mainstream outlets couldn't just ignore the sort of shifts in the electorate, ignore the fact that people are really supporting candidates like Bernie Sanders. And so you do see more people identifying as democratic socialists being invited on, for example, to cable news, more sort of op-eds placed in mainstream publications, but I do think that there is still among the kind of like pundit class who have not, for the most part, sort of changed in personage since 2016, still this real sort of fixation on sort of, you know, not just saying that their forecasts are totally correct, being kind of unable to acknowledge that, this far out, we're all sort of likely to be wrong. Mm-hmm. About what's going to happen 5 or 6 months down the line. But, you know, they are, I think, acknowledging the problem in some, you know, with more openness than others.
One of the things that I noticed in the first few months of the primary were, and this sort of gets to the forecasting and the belief that they were always right, even when they were proven wrong. In 2016, Bernie Sanders, he was basically alone in terms of some of the policies he was pushing for in the party on healthcare, minimum wage, climate change, all of that. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that many of these pundits thought that those ideas were crazy then. And now many of the candidates that they're more inclined to support say that they support those same policies. And there was this thing for a few months where they had to admit that he had pushed the party on those areas. But that was almost used more as ammunition to say, and now you can exit stage left. Is that something that you noticed too?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the kinds of ideas that Bernie was sort of laughed out of respectability for raising in 2016, for instance, things like Medicare for All, there's now a pretty broad acknowledgement, in part bolstered by high polling numbers for these sorts of policies, and the fact that most of the Democratic field is now embracing them, that those are, you know, rapidly entering the mainstream and are now the sort of center of the Democratic Party's policy conversation. What I think has happened both in the mainstream media and within the sort of upper echelons of the Democratic Party is kind of what you talked about, which is that people will give Bernie sort of credence for raising these ideas, for pushing them into the mainstream. But then, you know, say, well, you've had your time, Bernie, that's great. Now it's time for you to go. And so these other people who were, you know, voicing your ideas can take the stage.
In your op-ed, you talk about one other area that this sort of the ideology of the people who are disinclined to be interested in him can manifest, where it's not just in the headlines and the coverage, but also in the debates. I mean, we've only had one so far, and there will be many. But there was definitely a sort of framing of the way that these proposed policies were talked about from the point of view of the moderators. And how would you describe the way they talked about policy debates in the party?
Right, it sort of sounds like it had been written in a lot of the questions that, you know, for instance, people like Savannah Guthrie and Chuck Todd asked during the debate, sort of sound like they were cooked up by like a Republican strategist in 1991. And you know, I think those people would be thrilled if these were the questions being asked in the Democratic primary in 2019, if you had asked them back then. I don't think it's necessarily malicious. I don't think you know, Chuck Todd or Savannah Guthrie or any of the other moderators are sort of consciously even being right wing necessarily. But you know, by asking sort of what kinds of risks student debt cancellation or free college pose to the economy, you know, capital E, that, you know, adopts a sort of understanding that there is some risk, you know, to absolving sort of trillions of dollars of student debt, which assumes, I think, that you're speaking from a position of being more friendly to companies like Navient, who, of course, profit off of student debt, than, you know, the many, many more millions of people who are carrying that student debt burden.
Exactly. And of course, we'll have many more primaries or debates to see if this continues. But thank you for identifying what you've noticed so far. Kay Aronoff, as always, we appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back. New developments on the tech expansion in New York City and the woman who was attacked for opposing it. We dwell in a political world of multiple realities, and in one version of reality, what happened a few months ago when Amazon was considering expanding into New York with a new headquarters was that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a new representative at that time, led a group in opposing Amazon there, drove them out of the city and cost something like 25,000 jobs. That was just accepted as true, that it happened, that it had that effect, and that she was in charge of it. And that led to things like in the New York Times, headline that says Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is top villain in Amazon pullout poll finds. That's from a bit ago. Another headline from the New York Daily News editorial board, AOC's Amazon ignorance. Ocasio-Cortez proves she doesn't get how the deal worked or is willfully misrepresenting its terms. So either stupid or duplicitous. You had the Washington Examiner saying AOC blew Amazon out of New York in 2019 over tax breaks, but demanded one for herself. If you actually read further into it, which I doubt many people at the Washington Examiner page do, it said that in 2012, she was a businesswoman seeking tax benefits for her startup, Brook Avenue Press, which publishes books and curricula for children in the Bronx. It was a prospective bill that would have expanded a tax credit for small businesses from $5,000 to $10,000. So $5,000. Amazon was going to get more than $5,000, it turns out. They were going to get $3 billion to come in tax incentives. And it didn't happen. And she was a big dummy, right?
I'm with you, John. I don't know how to support you right now, but it sounds like they're making she's a dummy. You're
well,
right.
You've been doing some research into how that whole battle was presented on Fox News.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good. Good. I did do
that
some production.
Big dumb dummy.
Big dumb
AOC
dummy.
Ruined everything.
Yes. Dana Loesch went on Fox and Friends and was super mad about it. Take a look.
She has an egregious financial illiteracy problem, and I think maybe she needs to get a refund on her degree.
Well, can you believe she was celebrating? I mean, this is a major company. It could bring billions of dollars. It could bring lots of jobs, and she was celebrating that we lost the deal.
When you have 200 cities competing for the same company, you have to sweeten the deal. Some people weren't happy with the type of deal that Amazon got, but that's what happens when you're a corporation that's the fastest growing maybe in the world, and they promise to come, you got to swap to do this.
Okay, so they sort of acknowledge there that she does have a degree in economics, and I'm assuming there are some degrees around that desk, but you can judge for yourself based on watching the show what they're
worth. Degrees of stupidity, varying from sort of to extreme.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there was that.
There was not just that, John.
Stupid.
She's so stupid. Stuart Varney.
He's the business guy.
Businessman Stuart Varney had this to say about how dumb AOC is. Idiot.
I'm Stuart Varney, and this is My Take, coming to you today from the People's Republic of New York. We are no longer the Big Apple. We are a big socialist mess. Amazon will not build a campus in the city. It will not bring in 25,000 very high-paying jobs. They're not coming. The socialists killed the deal.
Okay, so because we did not shower Amazon, an incredibly wealthy company with $3 billion, we're a socialist mess. Was there more to that?
There's more. Are you kidding?
There's more.
This is actually the best. This is when it really gets rolling.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look.
Here's something incredible. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez actually accused Amazon of exploiting workers. Tell me, please, how do you exploit 25,000 people at an average income of $150,000 a year? Please, exploit me, why don't you? The Democrats are now learning the downside of AOC. She and her socialist colleagues hate business, they hate wealth, they hate capitalism. After this debacle, will any business move to New York or any city dominated by leftist politicians?
No, they won't.
They couldn't.
They won't.
How could they?
You saw the proof of it. That B-roll over the shoulder of the Capitol building and money flying all over. Like one of those fairground activities where you have to grab the dollars and put them in your pocket.
I think it's politicians and it's lobbyist money. And they're just grabbing it. Okay, so business analyst Stuart Varney presenting his own take, which is a novel take on news, providing commentary that's from your own point of view. So he's there to evaluate the intersection of politics and the economy. And he just said it there. This is a socialist hellhole that they've created there. So why would any business go there? Well, I assume at this point you probably know where this is going. But fast forward a little bit. In the Wall Street Journal, this is from yesterday. Who needs Amazon HQ 2? Not New York. Real estate's tech boom. And so we're not going to go through all of the article. But it talks about things like this. Alphabet Inc.'s Google last week closed a deal to lease 1.3 million square feet in Lower Manhattan, part of Google's plans to add 7,000 in staff to the city over 10 years. Facebook is in talks to lease 1 million square feet of office space at 50 Hudson Yards, a skyscraper under construction on Manhattan's far west side. Uber Technologies and Amazon have been looking for large office space at the Farley Building. And some of this should be fairly obvious. I mean, at the time we had discussions about why it was so pointless to shower a company in money to come to a place that they desperately want to come to. But some of the reasons include this from Kevin Egan, executive at Oxford Properties Group, saying New York has lured the talent and now the employers need to set up shop to lure that talent. These tenants want to be here and need to be here. Economist James Parrott also said social media companies have to sell ads to have revenue streams and New York City is the advertising capital. If you want smart people in advertising, you have to come to New York City for that. And so despite all of the doom and gloom predictions that she had doomed New York, these companies are still expanding, including Amazon, which is massively buying up real estate. Now, it might not be the exact same plan for HQ2, but they are opening up new offices, they are hiring new people, and they're competing in that process with literally every other big tech company in the country.
Yes. This is one of those things where essentially what she did was save taxpayers money.
$3 billion.
$3 billion. And there's a bunch of different things. Like when Trump said, listen, Boeing, we don't want you to bilk us out of millions of dollars for that fighter jet. Republicans were like, well, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. But in this situation, when AOC says, listen, Amazon, we don't want you to bilk New York City and Queens out of billions of dollars in tax revenue, then she is vilified for it. And another little aspect of it is they also are trying to vilify these cities. So the right tries to vilify New York City and California. Not a day goes by when there isn't a story about homelessness in Los Angeles. And that is a major problem. But in this situation, the talent, the industries are in New York and Los Angeles, and that's where people are moving, abandoning these like rural areas to have to go to the big cities in order to do that. So in a way, we just prove that your capitalist system works without socialism.
Yeah.
Without the socialist propping up of giant corporations and giving them money and paying them off, giving them millions of dollars in handouts to do what they should, what the market in this situation determined it had to do anyway.
Exactly.
So not only are they wrong in ways that are pretty obvious, but even on their own logic, it doesn't hold up.
Yeah, look, if there was any justice, there would be the New York Daily News. Their editorial board should be meeting right now to apologize to AOC with a big headline. Like, hey, thank you for saving our city billions of dollars. That's not gonna happen. Lawrence O'Donnell tweeted something really nice about AOC saying that she had been proven right. But I have not seen a lot of, and that's the issue. Everybody's always right. Everybody's always right. So if I predict that she is a fool, and then it turns out that I was wrong, there's no incentive for me to admit it in political commentary analysis and all of that. Stuart Varney is not gonna be doing mea culpa or whatever on.
I would just say so the places that are mentioned in this article are all in Manhattan and not Queens. So essentially what you're doing is bringing in these high paying tech jobs that were supposed to go to Queens. They're going to Manhattan, which does have like issues with affordable housing, but they're not going to be affecting Queens in the way that AOC was pointing out they would be affecting Queens.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wonder. I mean, some of the concerns were over, it artificially driving up housing prices. I imagine that, look, the job might be in Manhattan. Some of the people might still have to live in Queens. So some of those concerns might be the same. I guess we'll have to see.
There will still be fallout from this in Queens, but it won't be that megalopolis that they were trying to build on the bank of the river.
Now, I just want to read one more tweet. This is from AOC from yesterday. Well, just as we said, Amazon quietly came to New York City without needing a dime of public money or special tax treatment. The jobs came without the cost. New York City is an attractive place to locate on its own, including public infrastructure, without billions of dollars in corporate giveaway incentives. And the thing is, just to put a bow on this, it might be that Stuart Varney and Kilmeade or whoever, that was Kilmeade, right, in that video?
Kilmeade now.
They might all really wrongly believe that you have to give these corporations billions of dollars. But the thing is, this is a time when, from their ideological standpoint, it doesn't matter if they're right or not. It might not be that you have to give the corporations billions of dollars, but they don't mind giving the corporations billions of dollars. The government is supposed to be in service to these CEOs, to these massive corporations. And so it's just sort of convenient that they are willing to lie down, to surrender. As Stuart Varney said, exploit me, please. That's the Republican Party's mantra to these capitalist overlords.
Yep.
Okay, we do have to take a break. When we come back, lots more. It's 2019, but on certain topics like Nazism and respect for public health, it sometimes feels like it's like 75 years ago. And because of the public sentiment towards things like vaccines, we're seeing some significant backsliding and new outbreaks of things that it seemed at one point that we had in the bag. Joining us now to break down why the anti-vax movement is getting so much time in the media and is able to stand up to sort of irrefutable scientific evidence opposing their position, Sabrina Mulley, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming here. So we've seen for the past couple of years, it feels like, certain areas where we've had new outbreaks of things like measles and other diseases and high profile, fairly prominent anti-vax voices. Talk to me about the media treatment of this movement.
Well, I think the media has been giving it a lot of attention, and a big reason has been social media. Parents are sharing their misinformation. They're sharing posts that talk about the link between measles and autism, which there is none. And it's just been a widespread, effect. It's happened in the past few years like wildfire. We've seen pockets of measles when measles has been effectively eradicated since 2000, starting sprouting up in places that we've never seen it before.
And so, it somewhat feels like this is one of the areas where the media should be fairly clear on where the science is. And I don't always get that from the coverage of it. It seems sometimes like there's a bit of a sort of sympathetic take on it, like that this could be just a thing that's up to parents' rights or something like that. Do you agree with that? And if so, why is it that the media is not being more sort of obvious in where the science lies?
I think the media feels that parents have a sense of responsibility over their children. A lot of parents aren't doing this because they're trying to hurt their children. They truly feel that they're doing the best that they can. And when you have somebody coming out like Jessica Biel saying parents should have a right and should be able to do what's best for their children, some people might take that to mean she's an anti-vaxxer and that my choice is to not vaccinate my children.
Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure that we understand what's in the media and what's actually out there. So it definitely looks like more people are choosing not to vaccinate their kids. But do we actually know if that's the case? Or is this just the fact that high profile outbreaks are receiving more media coverage? Is it actually the case that more parents are choosing not to vaccinate lately?
Absolutely, because there has been such an increase in the outbreaks we've seen across the country. Parents are willingly choosing to not give their children vaccinations. We've seen that in New York, where Mayor de Blasio recently implemented a mandate because pockets in New York City where parents are choosing not to vaccinate their kids have a huge spike in the measles outbreak.
So I guess the question then is, it's a question of cause and effect. So some of these parents say, we believe that there's a connection between vaccinations and things like autism. I or a scientist might say, I think there's a connection between not vaccinating and getting measles. And the thing is, we've seen it. I mean, the outbreaks are becoming more common. So why is it that that connection and the obvious, the fact that these outbreaks are becoming more common, why is that not doing more to dissuade some of these people from their new position?
Because parents are using this reverse type of mentality. They're saying, even though all these other kids are vaccinated, look at this outbreak. But a real reason is that more kids aren't getting vaccinated. The point of vaccination is to have this herd type of immunity. So if more children are vaccinated, you know, the likelihood of it spreading is going to be smaller. And parents are just, they're misinformed. And this information that's out there is just so misleading.
Do you have any advice on what we can do in the media to try to break through that? Is there a way to inform them that won't run up against their sort of natural defenses against what they see as the media being complicit with these scientists?
So a huge part of that is doctors being more vocal and being able to get their information out there. And it's really hard. Things like Instagram, Facebook, all this social media is trying to take down this misinformation. And what's happening is they can't keep up as fast as this stuff is coming out. If you look on Amazon, one of their top vaccine books were anti-vaccine books. So I think the false and the spread of this anti-vaccine movement is just so much faster than people can get the correct information out there.
Are there any lessons we can take from other countries that have either dealt with anti-vax movements or have dealt with outbreaks of other sorts? Like there were, you know, the outbreaks of Ebola a few years ago. There's currently, you know, a smaller outbreak as well.
Of course, if you look at countries like the Sudan, where measles has been rampant, these people aren't able to get vaccines. Especially during this time when it's a rainy season, helicopters and transportation to get the vaccines to the communities in rural areas aren't getting there fast enough. So in countries where they want to be vaccinated and they want to protect their children, they're not getting it. And we have this privilege in America to make that choice.
Well, Sabrina Mulley, associate editor at The Hill, we do appreciate you joining us on this topic.
Thank you.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back, just a little bit more time. Campaign donation email from the organizing arm behind the Republicans in Congress uses Colin Kaepernick, but wait till you see what they did to him. The Republican Party just can't seem to quit Colin Kaepernick. It feels like they've been talking about him and using him for their own purposes for literally years at this point, and that continues. Although the most recent use of Colin Kaepernick by the Republican Party is drawing some, I think, much deserved scrutiny. Take a look at an ad that they sent out to raise money for congressional Republicans. So if you take a look at this here, you're gonna see, who do you stand with? Donald Trump and the Betsy Ross flag, or anti-American flag Colin Kaepernick, who's looking quite scary there. Look at him compared to the bright, happy, fresh-faced Donald Trump. Well, many people noticed that image did look a little bit odd, like it had been manipulated in some fashion. And so people have pointed out that yes, it does look like that image might have been darkened. Now those concerns were raised and sent to the party behind it. In an email to Yahoo News, the NRCC communications director Chris Pack insisted the photo was not darkened. So that sounds like the end of the story, but you can actually take that image before it was put into that ad and compare it to the one in the ad. Let's take a look. Yeah, he's clearly been darkened there. And it's not like this is the first time the Republican Party has done this.
I refuse to believe that, John.
Well,
here's the thing
happened.
About it. Like, they chose that picture anyway because his natural hair freaks people
freaks out.
It's already scary to them. The fact that they would feel the need to darken it, like they did, obviously you just proved it, but like they chose that picture of him looking like that in and his eyes being held in a certain way, like to put on purpose to scare people because they're like, oh my God, how dare he have that? And look at his tattoos. He's frightening me, and they use the word stand.
Yeah, I really wonder.
Who do you stand with? And he's kneeling. It's just sick by now.
I just want to know who did it, whose decision it was. Was it the guy that they had make the graphic, or was he ordered at some point to darken his image? And it just seems like Like we have to constantly have debates with right-wing pundits about whether racism exists in this country. And nothing breaks through, not the obvious fear-mongering implicit in photoshopping like this. Obviously not the institutional racism legacy, all of that. It's just this ridiculous wheel that we have to keep running on when they're choosing to do this. Somebody, I don't know who it was, probably wasn't the head of the NRCC, but somebody on down the line in this process decided it's not enough to fearmonger about this guy exercising his constitutional rights to protest. We have to scare him up some more.
Can we go back to the original photo of the side by side of Trump and so they photoshopped, that's not an actual photo of Trump. So they're photoshopping anyway. And there is no Betsy Ross flag in that original photo of Trump. You could tell by what's going on around his hairline.
Yeah.
So they photoshopped Trump, and also the whatever camera was taken there is not gonna have that depth of field. yeah. It's true. So you would not have a perfectly focused picture in the background. So they're photoshopping anyway. And they draw it out, they make the photo of Donald Trump more vibrant in color. And also they're doing that really cool ripped page thing.
Yeah.
but it's so dumb because no one cared. No one on the right who wasn't a white supremacist cared about the Betsy Ross flag at all or thought about it until now. And now they absolutely feel that they must. Not to mention just we've covered this on Main Show, the polls that go out from Donald Trump's campaign, which are like, who do you stand with on keeping people safe? President Donald Trump, or literally the other option is MS-13 loving Democrats.
So when I was learning how to construct polls in graduate school, that checks out.
That's exactly how you do it.
By the way, this is just sort of a weird irony thing. Like they're pointing out the reason we hate Colin Kaepernick, it's not because he's black, it's because he hates the flag. That's not actually what his protest is about, but that's what they say. And they always say that. The Democrats don't appreciate the flag. Then why is it that the Republicans are constantly looking for other flags to love? Like the Betsy Ross flag, like forget all the mythology about how that was actually made, but it is a different flag. The Confederate flag is a different flag. Why do they keep worshiping these other flags when they supposedly are in love with this one?
America's 243 years old, but in many ways it's like 12. Because like—
So in three more years.
It's very, it'll be perfect for Epstein. But it's very hormonal, everybody hates everything. But that's also the age when you find out Santa Claus is like a not— spoiler, not real. And the myth is like instead of Santa Claus, like the world is, America's built on, it wasn't elves that made all your toys. It was like slavery that gave us an economic advantage that we're still benefiting from. And the Democrats in that situation are the kid who, when you tell them about Santa Claus and the legacy of racism, Democrats are the ones like, oh, I already knew, Mom. Like I knew it was all racism. And the Republicans, well, yes.
There are horrible
people
on all sides.
But the Republicans are those kids who are like, no, that's not true. I need Santa and I need this myth and you're taking away from me. And then the leadership of the Republican Party is like, and a lot of America is like, no, just let them believe. You're right. It's Santa Claus. It's Santa Claus. There's no slavery. There's no racism about anything. And these are the moments where you call it out and you're like, hey, this is obviously like, They're trying to propagate this myth that like this guy's evil and taking away the greatness of the history of our country from day one. And folks are just like, no, this is a myth that they're perpetuating. And I think we're old enough to be able to handle it. And when Spike Lee says stuff like racism is sewn into the fabric of the Betsy Ross flag, he's just saying like, when that happened, there was slavery.
Yeah.
From the people that, but they're like, no. George Washington is Santa Claus. He's perfect. Everything was great. Nothing he did was bad. But we just think that now that America's 243 years old, we need to be able to say, hey, let's treat each other like grownups.
Yeah. I don't know if we have time. Just really briefly, I remember—
We don't. Wrap it up. Thanks for watching.
Al Franken in one of his books said that the idea that one party loves America and the other doesn't is always gonna be untrue and at the very least unpersuasive to the other side. In fact, both sides love America, but they love it differently. Like he says that Democrats love America like a grown-up kid who realizes his mom was an alcoholic loves his mom. Still loves her, but he can get that she has a problem and it needs to be fixed. The Republicans also love America, but they love their mom like that same kid, but when he's a kid. where right. it's like he doesn't get it and he's not emotionally stable enough to accept it.
Yeah.
And so he just attacks you if you point out that the mom should go to rehab.
And that's how I love yeah. Al Franken.
Okay. That's gonna get me in trouble. Okay, thank you for most of your presence on the show today. Not at the very beginning, at the very end. It sort of tailed off there, but we do appreciate you being here. Thank you everybody for watching throughout the week. Don't buy the Fountainhead. We'll see you next Monday.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.